In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
So we're back to Luke's Gospel this morning. We're going to be looking at chapter 6, if you're following along, which I always encourage you to do. But we see in the beginning of chapter 6, there's this controversy between Jesus and the Pharisees over the Sabbath. We've had a little bit of a break, so if you think back to where we were before Easter and then before I was on holiday, remember that we're just coming to the tail end of a section where that began in chapter 4. And in this section, St. Luke gives us a series of little snippets or vignettes showing us Jesus' ministry as he traveled around Galilee in the northern part of Palestine. Jesus preached that he'd come to bring sight to the blind and release to the captives and good news to the poor. And in each of these episodes, we see him doing just that in some way or another. In each of these episodes, Luke puts emphasis on showing us, as Jesus does these things, Luke puts emphasis on showing us who Jesus is, what's the nature of his ministry, and he especially shows us precisely who these poor people are that Jesus has come to declare good news to. Because they aren't necessarily the poor people that most of the people of that day expected the Messiah to be ministering to. For the most part, the poor that Jesus was ministering to were people on the outside. People had heard that a man who just might be the Messiah had come, but Jesus doesn't act the way that most of them expected the Messiah to act. They expected him to save God's faithful people from their pagan oppressors, from the Romans and the Herodians. But what we're starting to see in Jesus' ministry is that Jesus is identifying a problem that's much bigger than just the Romans or the Herodians or even the pagans outside of this little community of Israel. Jews didn't so much need to be saved from the oppression of pagans. What's needed is for Jew and Gentile alike to be saved from the oppression of sin and death. All these other things are just symptoms of that bigger problem. And so each of these episodes that Luke gives us points to Jesus as Lord of sin and death. And it's got the attention of the Pharisees. We've already seen this. Word got around. In chapter 5, the Pharisees had heard and they came to check Jesus out. They came to listen to him. And it seems like maybe even they came to inquire and ask him some questions, to vet him and see how he fit into maybe their plans. And then in today's lesson, we see just how concerned they are with what Jesus is saying and doing. Remember that the Pharisees had no legal authority in Judea. They were a protest group. They were opposed to the conservative and compromising ruling party, the Sadducees. Their concern was that Israel had compromised too much and for too long, and that when she finally returned to faithful observance of the law, of the Torah, then God would finally come, God would finally end Israel's long exile, and God would finally return and reestablish his presence with his people. Remember, they had the temple in Jerusalem, but God's presence hadn't been in it for hundreds of years. The Jews had returned from exile to their land, but they didn't rule it themselves. They lived there while the Romans and the Herodians ruled over it. And so the Pharisees were anticipating and looking forward to that day when God would come and fix these problems and be with his people again. But their agenda was to call people back to holiness. When we're holy enough, then God will come back. And now Jesus is undermining their agenda. They were all about purity. They wanted to exclude the impure. They wanted to be sure that outsiders were kept on the outside. But Jesus came, and here he's preaching the kingdom, but he's welcoming the outsiders and the impure in. And as we see now, they're concerned enough to be following him around and spying on him. The Pharisees are at the point where they're starting to dig for dirt on Jesus. They want to find grounds to make some kind of formal charge against him with the people who are in authority. So chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. Luke says, "On a Sabbath, while he was going through the grain fields, his disciples plucked and ate some heads of grain, rubbing them in their hands. But some of the Pharisees said, Why are you doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath? So that Luke tells us that this happened on the Sabbath, that stresses the importance of the story. Jesus' disciples weren't stealing. That's not the problem. I've seen some people say, why weren't the Pharisees upset that Jesus' disciples were stealing grain? They weren't. According to Deuteronomy, if you go back to Deuteronomy 23, that allowed you, if you were a traveler and you were walking through someone's vineyard or walking past someone's field, it was perfectly fine for you to grab a handful of wheat and to eat it, or to grab some grapes and you could eat your fill of grapes. What it said was, you can't harvest that wheat with a sickle. You can't fill a bushel with grapes and take it out of the vineyard. You could eat, but you couldn't harvest. Again, the problem for the Pharisees was that the disciples, they did this on the Sabbath. Now, it's not very likely that they would have made a fuss over that sort of thing if anybody else had done it. We don't have any reason to believe the Pharisees were out there scattered around the community, watching everybody to make sure they didn't break the laws. The Pharisees are specifically spying on, they're following Jesus because they're looking for dirt on him. And that's what's going on here. They're looking for anything that they can use to lay against him a formal charge. Now, so they're upset because in picking this grain, Jesus' disciples are violating the Sabbath regulations. And as far as the Sabbath regulations went, the law itself didn't forbid plucking a little grain if you're a hungry traveler and passing by a field. What the law forbade, at least as Moses recorded it, it forbade harvesting on the Sabbath. But over time, in trying to clarify the law for the people, the scribes, who were sort of like the religious lawyers of the day, the scribes had interpreted plucking as a form of harvesting. That's the basis for the Pharisees' charge. Now, they probably could have made other charges too based on their interpretations of it, because that later tradition, based on that, these disciples could also have been accused of threshing and winnowing and probably even grinding, because if you're familiar with grain, you can't just pull the grain off the stalk. You've got all the chaff and the little pointy things that grow on the top. Some of you guys are from the prairies, right? And you got to get rid of that. So they rub it in their hands and throw away or blow away the chaff, and you've got the grain that you can eat. So they're not just harvesting. They're also winnowing and threshing. And, if you're really sticklers, they're grinding. Now to us, it seems like they're quibbling over minor technicalities. But you have to remember, and this isn't just a problem for the Pharisees, most of the Jews wouldn't have seen this as quibbling. Notice that even though the Pharisees' accusation isn't based strictly on the law, strictly on what was written by Moses, it's based on a later interpretation of the law, they didn't have to explain themselves. There was no argument with Jesus over whether they were interpreting it rightly or wrongly. Everybody, more or less, accepted this kind of interpretation. And the reason they accepted it was because they understood the importance of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was at the core of the Jewish identity. It was at the core of their understanding of themselves as God's people. I mean, consider yourself as, say, a first century Jew. You're living in this world where you're surrounded by Gentiles and pagans. You're essentially living in exile in your own land that God had promised, with pagans and Gentiles all around you. And so that reinforced in them the need to be separate and to be apart. Remember, when they came back from exile in Babylon, many of the people intermarried with the locals who had been moved in and settled in Palestine while they were gone. And Ezra rebuked them for that. And so that underscored their identity. They needed to be separate. They needed to be apart. You don't mix with Gentiles. And so at the core of their identity and their separateness and what defined their distinct identity in Jesus' time were three main things. I mean, you had the whole law, the whole Torah, but it was summed up. It was really exemplified in three things. One was circumcision, one was food, and one was Sabbath. Now, circumcision, that's easy, because circumcision was the entrance into God's covenant. Every Jew was circumcised. That was the visible sign of God's covenant that they bore. That was distinctive. And the Gentiles, well, the Gentiles, they were laboring 7 days a week. The Jews observed the Sabbath. That was part of their sign, the sign that God had given them of their keeping of the covenant. Therein was to observe the Sabbath. So while everybody else is working, the Jews kept the Sabbath, we would say religiously. And even the pagans, the Jews, they had strict dietary rules. And that set them apart from the pagans as well. They didn't eat with pagans either. It all had to do with purity and cleanliness. Even the pagans understood how important these markers were to Jewish identity. Greeks and Romans would occasionally write about the oddness of the Jews' practice of observing the Sabbath. And periodically, when the pagan rulers would come and they'd want to throw their weight around, oftentimes if there was a revolt or a rebellion, what would the Greek or Roman rulers do? But they'd round up the ringleaders and they'd try to force them to eat pork. So circumcision, food, and Sabbath. Those were the three things that the Jews of Jesus' day saw as the primary markers of their special identity and the things that set them apart. So there's a good reason why Jesus addresses the Sabbath here. There's a good reason why when we look at the book of Acts, the first time the first Jewish Christians are supposed to go and meet with Gentiles, God addresses it with Peter, with the sheet and the animals coming down and the clean and the unclean and telling Peter, eat. They had to deal with that food issue. So these were big indicators for the Jews of their identity. And so in accusing Jesus' disciples of violating the Sabbath, what the Pharisees are doing is sort of accusing Jesus and his friends of abandoning God and abandoning the covenant and of abandoning their identity. If the Pharisees can make this charge stick, they can undermine Jesus' credibility. People might start looking at him as an outsider. How can you be the Messiah if you don't act like one of us? How can you be the Messiah who's supposed to come and you know, judge and smite the Gentiles and our oppressors if you're acting like them instead of us? That's sort of what the Pharisees are up to. Now, what's really interesting about this is in Jesus' response. Because if we just read this far and none of us were familiar with the story any further, what we might expect Jesus to do is to defend himself and say, no, friends. We're not violating the Sabbath. Yes, we're violating your rules that you've made up to try to help people observe the Sabbath. But go back and look at what Moses wrote. We might expect Jesus to try to correct the Pharisees and get rid of all these man-made rules and go back to what Moses wrote and say, no, it's okay to pluck a little grain to eat as we're traveling. We're not harvesting. Harvesting is what you're not supposed to do on the Sabbath. We'd expect Jesus to try to correct the Pharisees on their understanding here. But that's not the direction that Jesus goes at all, because it's irrelevant. Luke says, Jesus answered them, "Have you not read what David did when he was hungry? He and those who were with him, how he entered the house of God and took and ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for any but the priests to eat, and also gave it to those with him? And he said to them, the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." So instead of arguing with the Pharisees about the legal niceties of Sabbath observance, Jesus tells them a story. And the story comes from 1 Samuel chapter 21. David had been anointed the king, but you remember Saul was still on the throne. For years, David was forced to travel around the countryside with his little band of friends, basically like a band of outlaws. He's the anointed king, but he's not able to take the throne because Saul won't let him. So on this particular occasion, David and his men were in trouble, and they went to the place where the tabernacle was, and they looked for help, and they sought help from a priest named Ahimelech. Specifically, David asked him for some bread so he could feed himself and his men. But Ahimelech tells him, "The only bread I've got is the bread of the presence." That was specially consecrated bread that was set aside in the tabernacle every Sabbath. It was an offering brought by the people, and the law said that it could only be eaten legally by the priests. But Ahimelech saw David's need, and he decided to give mercy priority over strict adherence to the law. So he made sure that David and his men were pure, they were ritually clean, and he gave them the bread of the presence to eat. Now, why does Jesus tell this story to the Pharisees? Well, Jesus reminds them of the story. They already knew it. He reminds them. He introduces it by asking that question, "Have you not read?" Of course they knew the story. Of course they'd read it. But Jesus' point is that they've read it, but they haven't understood it. Jesus' confrontation with the Pharisees has repeatedly done two things we've seen over and over. And he does the same thing here. First, he rebukes the Pharisees for their lack of understanding. And second, he uses each of these confrontations to assert his own identity, to let the people know who he is, why he's come. So here Jesus claims his right as the long-promised and the long-awaited Davidic king. Because you see, the issue isn't the specifics of the Sabbath observance or whether or not the Pharisees are being overly legalistic or adding man-made rules to what Moses wrote. The issue is the person of Jesus. The issue is his mission, what he's come to do. Because if David, by right of his being the anointed king, if David could override the law when it came to the bread of the presence, surely Jesus, who has himself been anointed king, and who is himself the true king of whom David was just the type and the shadow, surely Jesus has the right to override rules regarding the Sabbath. The Lord gave these rules to Moses in the first place. The Lord has a right to say how they're observed. David, we're told by Scripture, was a man after God's own heart. Despite all of his flaws, David's great desire was to do the will of the Lord. And Jesus makes the point here that he's like David in the same way. Jesus, too, is seeking to do the will of the Lord. Even if it looks to the Pharisees like he's breaking the law, he's being obedient, ultimately. So there's something bigger going on here than that the Pharisees don't yet understand, and it has to do with Jesus' identity. And that lack of understanding puts the Pharisees on the wrong side of things. And that's the other part of Jesus' rebuke. If we go back to 1 Samuel chapter 21 and chapter 22, there's more to the story than just Ahimelech allowing David and his men to eat the bread of the presence. There's a villain in the story too. Now, the big overarching villain in that part of the story is King Saul. He wasn't willing to give up the throne to God's anointed, to David. And so David was on the run. That's why he needed Ahimelech's help in the first place, because Saul was out to kill him. But more specifically, in the story where David eats the bread from the tabernacle, we're also told that one of Saul's men, a man named Doeg, was spying on David the whole time. And Doeg went back and reported to Saul what Ahimelech and David had done. And as a result, Saul called Ahimelech and his priests to him, and he ordered the execution of them all. 85 priests total executed because of this event. And Doeg himself was the one who carried out the order. Now, when Jesus reminded the Pharisees of the story, one that they would have known well, everybody knew, including the Pharisees, that David was the hero of the story, and that Saul and Doeg were the bad guys. They were the villains. But in bringing up the story in this context, in bringing up the story to address the Pharisees' accusation that he was violating the Sabbath, what Jesus is doing is putting himself in the role of David. And that means Jesus is putting the Pharisees in the role of Doeg. And think about it. They're being just like Doeg. They're skulking around, spying on Jesus and his disciples as they're traveling from town to town. And Jesus is saying, you'd better watch out. You don't want to go down in history like Doeg, Saul's spy. You don't want to go down as the villain who murdered Ahimelech and his priests. And so then Jesus, he strikes while the iron's hot. He strikes while they're thinking. In verse 5, he then says something that had to leave the Pharisees gasping. He says, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." Now, this is the first time that Luke tells us of Jesus using this title, Son of Man. It's a title that Jesus used to describe himself quite a bit. And it's a title that comes from Daniel chapter 7. Now, what does Son of Man mean? Because I think a lot of people sort of assume that Son of Man refers to Jesus in his humanity over against the title Son of God, which refers to Jesus in terms of his divinity. But that doesn't really have anything to do with what was going on in Daniel 7. The Son of Man appears to Daniel in his vision, and he appears to Daniel as a heavenly being, some kind of divine being. But Daniel describes him as the Son of Man. If you read the passage, it's sort of like you get the sense that Daniel sees this divine heavenly being, and he's grasping at language, at words to describe him. And all that he can get out is Son of Man. Daniel's basically trying to say that this divine heavenly being, surprisingly, looked like someone born a human, someone born of the human species, a Son of Man. And that's in contrast to the four scary beasts that Daniel also saw who represented earthly kingdoms. Here's a representative of the heavenly kingdom coming down, but he looks like one of us. So the Pharisees understood that very well. They knew Daniel's vision well. In fact, Daniel's visions were very popular in that day and age because they looked forward to the coming of the Messiah. It was what they were waiting for. This Son of Man in Daniel's vision is a representative of God's people and God's kingdom, and he comes in opposition to those four beasts representing earthly kings and kingdoms. The Son of Man was a royal figure presented before the throne of the Ancient of Days and given, as Daniel says, dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So you get a sense when Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man, this is what he's referring to himself as. He's the one everybody's been hoping for. He's the one everyone's been longing for. He's the one who's come to establish God's kingdom. He's the Messiah. And that means he is Lord of the Sabbath. So if David, as king, could make this one-time exception when it came to the bread of the presence, surely the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Surely, as the eternal king, Jesus has the right to redraw the lines for his people. And that's exactly what Jesus has been doing. Because think about it, the main identifiers of the Jews were circumcision, food, and Sabbath. You knew who the insiders were. You knew who the people in the club and in the group were because they observed circumcision, food, and Sabbath. You knew who was on the outside because they weren't circumcised. They didn't observe the Sabbath, and they didn't worry about what they ate. The Pharisees were even more concerned about these distinctions than the average Jew was. But we've seen Jesus repeatedly showing that his kingdom is about inclusion, not exclusion. Jesus hasn't given up on purity. Jesus still has standards, if you will. It's just that he's reorienting the standards of inclusion and exclusion around himself and around his identity. Now, the second half of the passage shows all of this put to the test. Again, chapter 6, this time verses 6 to 7. Luke ties them closely together. The first was on a Sabbath. Now he says, on another Sabbath, Jesus entered the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was withered. And the scribes and Pharisees watched Jesus, to see whether he would heal on the Sabbath, so that they might find a reason to accuse him. So notice, Pharisees are still spying on Jesus, still following him around, still looking for evidence so that they can make a case against him. And this time they think they've got it. Jesus is teaching in the synagogue, and sitting right there in the front row is a man with a withered hand. Now, it should say something to us about Jesus, the fact that they knew what was going to happen. They knew that Jesus routinely healed people. They knew that that was his business. That was his character. And so they expect that to happen. They also knew that Jesus broke their rules. And so here was the perfect setup. And Luke tells us the man's right hand was withered. Not his left hand, his right hand. That made it worse. For most of us, you could survive if your left hand was withered. But if your right hand was withered, that's more of a problem. But the fact that it was a man with just a withered hand is also part of the setup. As much as it's miserable for this man to have a problem hand, it's also not a life or death matter. He's probably been this way for years, maybe since birth. And according to the way the scribes applied the law, that meant that this man could be healed, but not on the Sabbath. He'd have to wait till the next day. Unless it was extremely urgent, you could only heal, you couldn't heal on the Sabbath. Now, Luke doesn't say so, so it's only speculation on my part, but I kind of have to wonder, because it's the perfect situation for the Pharisees here, if the man with the withered hand was a plant. Like, they set it up. They put this man there. They know what Jesus does, and they're digging for dirt. They want evidence. So they put this man there knowing that, according to their rules, he shouldn't be healed today. He doesn't have to be healed today, but we know Jesus is going to heal him today. It's a perfect setup, but Jesus knows. Remember back at the beginning of Luke's gospel, Simeon had said that Jesus would be one who revealed the hearts of many. Now look at verses 8 to 11. Luke says, but Jesus knew their thoughts. He knew what the Pharisees were thinking. And so he said to the man with the withered hand, come and stand here. And he rose and stood there, and Jesus said to them, I ask you. See, Jesus knows. He addresses the Pharisees directly. He says, I ask you, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it? And after looking around at them, he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he did so, and his hand was restored. But they were filled with fury and discussed with one another what they might do to Jesus. So this time, Jesus avoids doing anything that violates the technicalities of the law. He asked the man to stand, to stretch out his hand, and he himself simply spoke. And the man was healed. But nothing had been done that actually violated the law. It didn't even violate what the scribes interpreted the law as saying. Jesus hadn't even touched it. The man standing up, the man holding out his hand, Jesus talking, all of that was fine. But the Pharisees are mad because Jesus still healed him somehow. Darn you, Jesus, you healed him without breaking any rules. There was nothing they could make a case out of. So Jesus sort of sidestepped the legal issue. Doesn't get into a debate with the Pharisees about the niceties of the law. Jesus brings everyone's attention, though, to the real issue. Knowing what they were after, Jesus asked them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save life or to destroy it? Now, this is important because in asking that question, Jesus flips their understanding of the law upside down. Just think about the difference between how the scribes and Pharisees approached this question and how Jesus approached it. For the scribes, the Sabbath was the highest priority. For the scribes, even doing good took a back seat to the Sabbath. The scribes assumed that Sabbath observance was the highest priority, and then they asked how necessary something good had to be in order for it to override the observance of the Sabbath. Can you imagine that? Strict Sabbath observance, overriding doing good. How good does the good have to be in order to override the Sabbath? That's where they're coming from. For Jesus, on the other hand, doing good and giving life was the highest priority, and everything else, even the Sabbath, took a back seat. So do you see how they're coming at it from very different directions, from very different priorities? Yes, the Sabbath was one of the essential markers that set God's people apart. They were called to be a light to the Gentiles, and the observance of the Sabbath and the rest of the law was part of their testimony of faith in the Lord. That was part of their light. But even more important than the Sabbath, as a critical part of their testimony, was doing good and giving life. So this Sabbath problem highlights the much bigger problem we've been seeing all along. The bigger problem may have been exemplified by the Pharisees, but it was a problem that was endemic throughout Israel, throughout the Jewish population. It was their failure to be the light that God had called them to be. See, the law was intended to be a means for a holy people to reach out to a sinful world with the light and grace of God. But that's not what Israel had done. Yes, the law was the charter of their community. It was sort of the constitution. It was what distinguished insiders from outsiders. But it had been given as a means to reach out to the outsiders and to bring them inside. But instead of reaching out, the Jews had simply used the law to draw this protective boundary around their community, keeping everyone else on the outside, and then waiting for the day when the Lord would send his Messiah to rescue the in people and to vindicate their faithfulness to the law while smiting and destroying all of the people on the outside. And Jesus is showing that he's now come to take up that failed mission himself. He's revealing the light to the outsiders and inviting them to come inside. Now, Jesus did know, yes, in fact, the Lord will one day come. And on that day, justice will be done. The faithful will be vindicated and the faithless will be destroyed and punished. But because the Lord is merciful and gracious, he's provided a means for salvation, a way to go from being on the outside to being on the inside. That is Jesus' mission. That's the good. That's the giving of life that's at the heart of Jesus' priorities. And that's why we see Jesus stepping in as the Lord and as sovereign King and redrawing the boundaries, redrawing them around himself. Jesus is working to reshape the people of God. He's creating God's new Israel. And here at the beginning, we see in the early part of Luke's gospel, he's drawing the Jews back to what should have been their first priorities: doing good, healing, giving life. But in the process, he's also redrawing the lines of the kingdom so that he can invite outsiders to the inside so that they can take part in it. Again, Jesus reorients the identity of the kingdom and of God's kingdom people themselves around himself. And he does that as he fulfills the promises that had been given to Adam and that Adam failed to fulfill, as he takes on himself the promises and instructions given to Abraham that Abraham had failed to fulfill, and the promises and instructions and mission that had been given to Israel and that Israel had failed to fulfill. All of those promises are fulfilled in Jesus. That mission that humanity up to that point, that God's chosen people from Adam to Abraham to Israel had all failed to fulfill, Jesus is now fulfilling himself. Consider how in telling the story of David eating the bread of the presence that day, in telling that story, Jesus reoriented David's story around himself. Jesus is now the great king, the son of David, who's finally come. Consider we've just been through Holy Week and Easter. As Jesus was reorienting the Passover around himself, and he was showing that all along people had been celebrating the Passover in anticipation of his coming and his death and his resurrection. Well, this is why for Christians, the death and resurrection of Jesus are a new Passover. And they've replaced the old Passover as the central focus of our whole year. The Christian year is all oriented around Easter, around the death and resurrection of Jesus. It's also why we celebrate Jesus' reoriented Passover meal every Sunday, the Lord's Supper. But the fact that we gather on Sundays also points to Jesus' reorienting of the old covenant around himself. As Lord of the Sabbath, Jesus has himself become our Sabbath rest. Everything the old Sabbath represented has been fulfilled in Jesus. When he rose from death on that first Easter Sunday, Jesus ushered in a new age and a new covenant. So for the early Christians, the old week was done. In fact, they often referred to Sunday as the eighth day, the day on which Jesus began a new week and a new age and a new way of life. So brothers and sisters, our calling now as Jesus' people is to live out the life of that new kingdom and that new age. I ran across a quote from Bishop Tom Wright this morning about living out the victory of God. He says, "The call of the gospel is for the church to implement the victory of God in the world, Think about what that means as Easter people, as resurrection people. The call of the gospel is for the church to implement the victory of God in the world. The cross is not just an example to be followed. It is an achievement to be worked out and put into practice. Our calling is to be light in the darkness. Now, it's very easy for us to fall back into the old ways, to be like the Pharisees. We draw boundaries for the kingdom with ourselves on the inside, and we hunker down, and we live out our piety in personal ways with each other. But the whole time we sort of hunker down and we've circled the wagons and we wait and pray for the day when God comes to destroy all those evil sinners on the outside. It's easy to fall into that way of thinking that the people on the outside of the circle, on the outside of the boundaries, are our enemies. But as we celebrate Easter, remember that the people on the outside aren't the enemy. Sin and death are the true enemies, and Jesus has conquered them. He conquered them when he died and rose again. Our calling is then to carry the good news that Jesus is Lord, even over sin and death. Our calling is to carry that good news to the world and to all the people who are on the outside, all the people who are still in darkness. So, brothers and sisters, let us never use the boundaries of the kingdom as an excuse to avoid doing good. And let those boundaries never be an excuse for not taking Jesus' life-giving message to the people on the outside. Would you pray with me? Almighty God and Father, you sent your Son to die and rise again so that we might have life, so that our old enemies, sin and death, would be conquered. Give us courage to live out the victory of Jesus, to live out the new life and the new mission we've been given. Keep us faithful in carrying the light and the life of the risen Christ to the world. And let the boundaries of the kingdom never be an excuse to avoid our kingdom responsibilities. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.